Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Octavia Butler, and this is a special occasion. It's the 25th anniversary of the publication of her book that first came out in, is it 1979? Kindred. It's a remarkable book, really a breathtaking book. It was recently adopted in that program to have cities adopt books. Rochester read Kindred, as I understand it, just as Los Angeles read Fahrenheit 451, I believe. And first of all, it interested me in citing that fact that both of these books adopted by cities are considered to be science fiction, although their writers have some amount of, what would you say?
Well, Kindred really isn't science fiction just because there's no science in it. I don't know how people feel about Fahrenheit 451, but it kind of fits into science fiction, I guess, in the same way that my book Parable of the Sower does. It's not so much the science, it's the future, looking into the future. But Kindred is definitely not just... because I was called a science fiction writer, it gets called science fiction.
That's right. But had you any desire to be called that?
I didn't mind. When I was finally getting published back in the 70s, I was so happy to be published, you could have called me almost anything. My first three books were with the Doubleday science fiction side of Doubleday publishers. And on each cover, it said science fiction. Now, they were kind of throwaways because Doubleday then had an agreement, a subscription agreement with schools and libraries, and they knew they were going to sell a certain number of books no matter what, so they could take a chance on unknown people like me and sell a certain number of books with no real publicity effort, and then the books would die. And mine all made paperback, but for very small sums, and they died there too. And I had the impression that I was throwing away books, that at some point, you know, that had to stop because I was still working at some of the jobs that my character has in Kindred, still doing those horrible little jobs at that time, trying to support myself and write books.
The equivalent now of phone rooms, say, or...
Oh, I did that.
Yes. Now, what interests me here is because I've... Not only have I read the book, I've read a lot of writing about the book. And the character first appears in her room without an arm, cut from the elbow down. And for some reason, people find this still very strange. And yet, it occurred to me clearly that she, coming back from the South, from antebellum slavery, Maryland, a place where we've seen a man's ears cut off, her arm,
among other things, yes.
Among other things, yes. Her arm is missing because she's a writer. That's what she wants to be. And she's being deprived in some metaphorical way of the power of telling the story. Well, and that her life as a writer depends upon her finding the ability to say it.
That works, but the truth is, what I was thinking about, and I should tell people that Kindred is the story of a modern-day black woman who goes back in time to the antebellum South and who has to struggle to survive slavery. Now, her last trip back, she knows it's her last trip back because the person who's been calling her back, she eventually has to kill. And the reason that I had for her arm being stuck in the wall the way it was. It's the arm that he was holding. And it stuck there because she couldn't really come back from that experience whole, unmarked, and say, boy, glad that's over, and get on with her life. That experience marked her as slavery marked black people in this country. And that was what I was thinking about.
Because what I've read in these books has been that not only are these heroes and heroines seeking to define themselves in relation to their heritage, but they're seeking to define themselves as writers. That mm-hmm, writing is enormously important.
These two people,
yes. Yeah, and that this is, when people talk about identity in this book, it's not just racial identity or sexual identity. It's the identity, the right to write.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me as important in your books as any other act of definition.
Mm-hmm.
What was writing to you and reading when you were young?
Well, I began writing when I was 10 years old and realized I liked it. And then when my mother spotted me writing and asked what I was doing, I told her I was writing a story. I'd been telling myself stories for years. She said just casually, oh, maybe you'll be a writer. And that was my first inkling that there was such a thing as a writer, that people could actually get paid for writing. And all of a sudden, things looked a lot brighter because it was something I could do to earn a living that I actually liked. It really rescued me. It gave me a reason to, I guess, to stay in school, to endure the fact that I was painfully shy and had no social life. It just really became my life. So I guess you could say it's been my profession and my religion.
Now, I'm curious. One of the reasons that I know when I'm reading Kindred by my guest Octavia Butler that I'm in good hands is that on around, say, page 40 or maybe even later, it's not until then when they see a temporary boss sees Dana. Do you say Dana or Dana?
Her name is Idana, but I realize people are going to call her Dana because that her actual name only comes up once or twice.
Right. This boss sees Dana with her husband-to-be, Kevin, at a lunch counter. He knows that they're both going to write, and he says they're going to write pornography. And then he says,
I don't think that was a boss. That was a wino.
But he's on the job, too, isn't he? He's
yeah, there. But yeah. But she works out of a temporary agency that she refers to, before she finds out what the word really means, she refers to it as a slave market. And I used to work out of a temporary blue-collar agency. And some of the people, a lot of the people who show up for work in those places are winos because they can do a day's work, get some money, and go out and have more than they should to drink and then come back when they need some more money.
He says that they're going to write together pornography mm-hmm. and that it's going to be chocolate and vanilla pornography. Mm-hmm. And that's the first time the reader knows that this man that Dana lives with is a white man.
You didn't see it when she came back and was horrified and didn't want him to touch her? She came back from one of her time trips.
But being given what happens on those time trips, mm-hmm. being horrified at being touched seemed to me to be a reasonable response universally. And so I thought that I thought it was actually a touch of real narrative brilliance that we don't exactly know that until it's been really kind of obliquely introduced. Mm-hmm. What were the tools for your research? Because you are trying to create the conditions of slavery as a realistic enterprise. That's not science fiction. And yet these are, for the readers, the strangest and most horrifying things encountered in mm-hmm. Kindred.
There were different branches of research. The first was, of course, I went off to the library because that was always what I did when I was going to be working on a new book. And I went to the history room. This is the old L.A. Public Library before they modified it. And I went to the history room, and I really didn't find that much that was useful. For one thing, my character was going to be going to Maryland, to the eastern shore of Maryland. It's a small state. And I found some things that were useful, but I didn't really know how to research a historical novel. I didn't know how to find the little things, mm-hmm. what foods people were going to be eating, what furniture might be in their house, how they did the usual domestic chores that everyone had to do. Had to find out things like that. And one of my problems was finding out how they did the laundry. And I hunted and hunted in the library, was out of the history room fairly quickly and over into social science, reading slave narratives and that kind of thing. And finally I found out that, no, they probably didn't use washboards or go to the river and beat their laundry on a rock. They were much more likely to use big iron kettles where they heated the water, and then they used lye soap, of course, and they would beat the clothes with big wooden paddles. And it was like making yourself a human washing machine in a way. Hard physical work, especially in a place that's already hot. And just imagine a job like that in August. And I was so happy that I'd found out. I went home, and my mother phoned. We generally talk to each other every day. And she phoned and asked what I had been up to, and I told her. And she said, oh, yes, I can recall my own mother doing the laundry that way. I hadn't realized how near history was. My grandmother was born in the late 1800s, 1890-something. She didn't really know her birth date because her mother died giving birth to her, and she was in the care of people who really didn't care. So she had a hard life right from the beginning. And I only knew her for a short time during my life because when I was 10, she died. But there were other older people in my family that I realized I should talk to. And I did do a little bit of that, family research. So I did library research and I did family research. I also went to Maryland. I had very little money, but I went to I had very little money because I sold Survivor, my third novel, before it should have been sold. It really wasn't ready, but I sold it and used the money to take a Greyhound bus to Maryland. 3.5 days on the bus, nonstop. One day I came back to the bus station. My feet were hurting. I was tired. I came back to the bus station, and I was going to have 2 hours to wait before the bus to Baltimore was going to go. And I sat there and wrote what turned out to be the first and last chapter of the novel. Now, I didn't realize that's what it was, but I guess in a way that's where my mind was, just from walking the roads and kind of taking the place in.
I'm speaking to Octavia Butler. The Beacon Press has published a 25th anniversary edition of her novel Kindred, which was her fourth novel. Now, what fascinates me is I did not know your work because I have, I confess it, unless someone explains to me that a work of science fiction or mystery is special, I stay away. You know, it's almost as if I depend upon friends to pass me the valuable books in these fields, because I tend to think that unless the book is special, I might not like it. You know, but your work comes to me, in fact, via writing about it that's been done over the last 10 to 15 years. You've become a writer who is talked about when people are writing about gender studies, about queer theory, about, of course, ethnicity and identity. So that always the inner subject of your work, which is what eventually the critics found, or the critics who were writing about the other books that I cared most about, it was through them that I began to hear that these books were not your run-of-the-mill books. And indeed, they aren't. I mean, it seems to me that they're literature, you know, and they're...
And by the way, Kindred was published as a mainstream book originally. And then Beacon, of course, they never went on about science fiction. So it was probably more accessible than the others. What I do is kind of open to interpretation. Sometimes it is science fiction, as with Lilith Sprood. My three novels, Dawn, Adulthood, Rights, and Imago, all combined into one. But a book like the one you have there, Parable of the Sower, is no more science fiction than, say, The Handmaid's Tale. So it's just a matter of people wanting me to be one thing and one thing only.
Now, it seems to me that in the histories of oppression, there are several kinds of oppression. And there's the oppression that a writer faces as being stigmatized as a certain kind of writer. No one called Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale science fiction.
That's right.
Because they'd read Surfacing, say, or The Edible Woman. But if you start out in science fiction, the likelihood is that you're going to remain there. Now, you have done, it seems to me, quite a few things in order not to remain there, including being published by a small press, Four Walls, Eight Windows.
Yes, which became, well, the part of it that I wound up with was Seven Stories Press.
Because I want to venture something that I don't think has been sufficiently acknowledged, and I think it's one of the difficulties of literature in America. I would venture to guess, in fact, I'd go further, I would bet, that if the books continued to be published by Warner with the science fiction covers and the tendency to be paperback-only editions, that what happened several years later, the Genius Award from the MacArthur Foundation, might not have happened.
Might not have. Might not have.
Now, again, the image of the science fiction writer is of someone who, well, hyperbolically, writes 30 books in his or her first 2 or 3 years of writing and then follows
definitely
that.
Definitely hyperbole.
But you write a book around every 5 or 6 years.
When I began writing, I turned out a book a year, because I had all these ideas, and they'd been seething around in my mind since I was 12. After a while, I told the stories that had been living in my head for so long, and then I began to write much more slowly.
It seems to me that, certainly from Kindred on, that novel after novel handles material that the writer has had to first prepare herself to handle. That there's a pain, an explosiveness, a searing quality to the acknowledgments of the errors of patriarchy, not on a ideological level, but on the level of the body and the spirit and the emotions. That the novels are in agreement between the writer and her story to enter the story deeply and fully in a way that someone less engaged, or in a way, someone less antisocial than you.
I don't see myself as antisocial, but asocial. Uh-huh. I feel that if I am not in the book as I write it, if I'm not living in it, no one else will. I can't invite people in if I'm not there myself. And that's important to me. There are a lot of what I think of as cold books that are good books, but they're not, they don't engage you except intellectually. And I do want to reach people on more levels than that.
Well, I think that you reach people intellectually because you reach people on more levels than that. Hmm. So there's a scene in Kindred, for instance, that I didn't expect to find in the book at all. Is it Idana?
Dana. You can call her Dana, sure.
Okay. Is speaking to Alice. There is a young white master, Rufus, mm-hmm. the son of the owner of the plantation, not a very impressive plantation, mm-hmm. who has fallen in love
with Alice.
Obsessively with mm-hmm. Alice, a free black woman. Mm-hmm. He is perhaps able to fall in love with Alice because he has met Dana, who has come to mm-hmm. him through time. She is his instance of a black woman who saves his life. She might as well be, if we were giving it names, his guardian angel.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it is not unusual for him.
She certainly doesn't want to be and doesn't feel herself qualified to be.
Exactly. And not only that, Alice doesn't want Rufus.
No, she has another man in mind.
And here we find this woman, a realistic woman, a woman who's living in 1976 in Los Angeles, who's sitting with Alice, giving her her options. You can run away and get beaten worse or die. Mm-hmm. You can give yourself to him voluntarily, so-called, mm-hmm. or
and maybe you can, have a little bit of control.
And or you can give yourself to him against your will mm-hmm. completely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what we're seeing is a black woman appraising a black woman mm-hmm. of a really ugly reality.
Yeah. And it wasn't a reality that Alice was unaware of. It's just having someone put it into words. I have been criticized for that because people seem to think that my character is pushing Alice into this relationship, when the truth is there's no way my character could rescue Alice from this relationship. And all she's really doing is saying, here are your options. They're not nice options, but here they are.
At the moment, very significantly, it seems to me, or the significance arrives to me after the book has been emotionally loaded, mm-hmm. that interpretation can be made. Alice is in the process of making Dana a dress. Mm-hmm. Dana has arrived in
pants.
In pants, in jeans.
In other words, men's clothes.
Men's clothes. And everyone notices. It's the first mm-hmm. thing they notice about her, even mm-hmm. before they notice that she's black. Mm-hmm. This woman in pants mm-hmm. is here traipsing around the antebellum countryside. And Alice has to decide whether to burn the dress. You know, you do what you want, says Dana. You mm-hmm. know, this is what I have to tell you. I'm not really giving a brief for Rufus's case. Mm-hmm. Although I know him, I'm stating your own case mm-hmm. as accurately as I can. Mm-hmm. Now, the reality's here.
She actually does try to help her get away originally, but that doesn't work out.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So what I would say is that what makes these novels unusual is their willingness to brave what would become subsequently political incorrectness. Of a real sort to tell the truth, that you are so deeply inside the narrative that other people's objections about what a role model would do are irrelevant as opposed to the truth of the situation.
Well, they would be irrelevant to Alice's situation, too, of course. You know.
But I think they're irrelevant to you as a writer, too.
Mm. I wanted Dana to be pretty straightforward. As a matter of fact, most of my characters are, especially if they're first-person characters, very straightforward people. And I wanted her to be able to face the truth even if she didn't like it. And, of course, she doesn't like it. But there it is.
Now, why do you suppose it is? I mean, other of your books have celebrated a 25th anniversary. This was
And more.
yes.
Uh-huh.
And this was not a best-selling book when it came out. It's not a...
But it's been a good perennial seller. It's when Beacon picked it up, and I've forgotten what year that was, but it was some time ago. It kept selling. And Beacon did some good publicity work on it. So they've done a good job keeping it alive. And it has been accepted, as you mentioned, in Rochester. I was there for about 8 days speaking every day about Kindred to everybody from the junior high school to the old people's home. And that was an experience. Now, colleges, I'm sorry?
Exactly. When a city adopts a book...
Mm-hmm.
Again, this has got to be a milestone in a writer's life. It may not be in your
personal... It was lovely.
Yes.
It was lovely.
But does it change the way you regard yourself?
No. No, I spend most of my time in a room with a bunch of books and a computer. That's what I did 20 years ago, except not the computer but the typewriter. And that's what I do now. So, no. Most of my... regard for myself comes out of the work that I do, not the work that I did 25 years ago or 30 years ago, but the work that I'm doing now.
I've been talking to Octavia Butler. It's on the occasion of the 25th anniversary of her novel, Kindred. Her most recent novels are Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents. Thank you very much, Octavia, for joining me.
Thank you.
You can read an excerpt from Kindred on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna, and special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.